Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Okay, good evening, everyone. Okay, we have been studying the discourse on right view, the Samadhitti Sutta, and we are in the section on the Four Noble Truths, which begins with on page 134. With paragraph 13. And then last week I gave some general comments on the Four Noble Truths, and then I dealt in some detail with the first Noble Truth, the Noble Truth of Suffering, Dukkha Ariyasaccha. Okay, now we come to the second noble truth, which is called the Dukkha Samudayam Ariyasaccha, the noble truth of the origin of suffering. And so here we take the first, we'll take the word of the text. We're now in paragraph 16, page 135. What is the origin of suffering? It is craving, which brings renewal of being, or which leads to renewed existence, is accompanied by delight and lust, and delights in this and that, or I would say which seeks delight in this and that. That is craving for sensual pleasures, craving for being or craving for existence, and craving for non-being, craving for non-existence. This is called the origin of suffering. Okay, so here, after the Buddha has explained the first noble truth, the noble truth of suffering, then he proceeds to the second noble truth, in which he is tracing the what is called the origin of suffering, which means seeking the cause of suffering. And the Buddha's way of dealing with the problem of suffering is by seeking the cause. Because in order to get rid of the problem, one has to discover the cause and eliminate the problem at the level of the cause. If one just deals with the problem by treating the effects, the symptoms, then one will get a kind of symptomatic relief. But if the cause remains intact, the cause will continue to operate, and while the surface symptoms are being treated, the cause will continue to brew and will be producing more serious, even more dangerous types of suffering that will eventually erupt and find some way of breaking through the kind of symptomatic treatment that has been given to the manifest effects. It's said that, this is an illustration that comes in the commentaries, that other teachers, when they deal with the problem of suffering, it's somewhat like if somebody throws a stone at a dog, the dog will go running after the stone. But if somebody throws the stone at a lion, the lion will run after the man who threw the stone. And so to go treating just the symptoms of suffering, that is like somebody throws a stone at the dog. That is like the dog goes running after the stone. By tackling the stone, the dog is not going to stop the man from throwing more stones at it in the future. But if the lion comes running after the man who threw the stone, and the lion attacks and devours the man who threw the stone, then that man will not throw any more stones at the lion in the future. Okay, so actually the origination of dukkha, of suffering, is actually part of a complex process. It's not simply a matter of one cause giving rise to one effect. And a more detailed treatment of the origination of suffering is found in the formula of dependent origination, which shows that even craving originates eventually, ultimately, from ignorance. But in the formula for the Four Noble Truths, the Buddha singles out craving and gives it a kind of special place as the most fundamental cause, or I would say the most conspicuous cause. Or behind this screen, behind the smoke screen set up by ignorance, then craving plays this active role of propelling us into courses of action, modes of behavior, by which we create suffering for ourselves and for others. Okay, now in what sense do we say that craving is a cause or origin of suffering, of dukkha? Here I distinguish two roles that craving plays as the cause or origin of suffering. I call one the level of psychological causation, and the other the level of, I don't have an easy name for it, call it the level of, maybe we call it the level of deep causation. Okay, at the level of psychological causation, we could say that in our normal experience, our everyday experience, we can see that craving in many different ways becomes a cause of suffering. And I distinguish a number of different modes in which craving functions as a psychological cause of suffering. Okay, one is the level of craving when craving as the cause for suffering in the sense that craving becomes experienced as first a sense of lack, of not having something that we desire. And so when we have this experience of lacking something, then there comes wanting. We want what we don't have, and we imagine that by obtaining what we don't have, we will be able to satisfy ourselves and quiet down and eliminate our suffering. In other words, we think that by gratifying our craving, we will be able to find satisfaction. And so this is the craving of not having what one desires that causes a kind of suffering. Okay, then this craving propels us into courses of action by which we have to try to get what we want. This is, we call it the suffering of seeking, of struggling and striving to get the objects that we imagine will give us satisfaction. Okay, then when we obtain what we want, then we are able to enjoy this object that we've finally gotten. And even if one looks deeply within that enjoyment, there's still some deep level of suffering or displeasure. There's a certain degree of, say, maybe even comparison with previous experiences of pleasure, or just especially with sense pleasures, there's a kind of irritation of the senses involved. So the enjoyment of ordinary worldly pleasures is at certain levels bound up with pain. Okay, then once we obtain the possessions that we want, there is a suffering called the suffering of protecting what we have. This is, we now have things that we want. Now we have to preserve them, protect them. Because other people might be looking at our possessions and thinking that I want to take them over. So this is why people who are rich, often they have to hire personal security guards, live in gated communities. Or set up these security alarm systems around their homes to protect what they possess. Okay, but everything that comes into being is impermanent, and so there's always the possibility that the objects that we possess might be taken away from us. So that leads to the suffering of loss. If we lose the things that we want, then to the degree that we have clinging to them, then we will feel misery and upset when we lose them. Or else those things, even if they're not taken away, but eventually they deteriorate on their own and break down. Then when they break down, then there comes sorrow. Okay, so the Buddha in the Dhammapada, he says that it's from craving there comes fear. From craving there comes grief. For one who is free from craving, there is no fear, there is no grief. And so words like this can be readily understood by almost anybody who reflects on them. They don't require any particular belief system. They don't require any deep system of metaphysics. But if you just think, reflect upon one's own experience, one can see how craving produces anxiety, produces fear, produces grief when one loses the things to which one clings. Okay, this takes care of the level of psychological causation. We even find this level embedded within the first noble truth. The suffering of not to get what one wants is suffering. Here, the wanting is the craving, and not to get what one wants, that is the suffering. Okay, the second level of causation is what I call the deep level of causation. How craving produces dukkha, suffering. And here we have to take the meaning of dukkha not as psychological experience, but dukkha in the sense, as I explained last week, dukkha in the sense of these five aggregates subject to clinging. What are these five aggregates? The aggregates of form, bodily form, feeling, perception, volitional formations, and consciousness. Okay, why do these five aggregates exist in the first place? What is it, the thread that brings them together from life to life? It is this craving itself. Craving is that force, that driving force that keeps the process of samsara moving. And so this craving runs through our entire life from birth all the way through to the very end of life. And then this current of consciousness in which craving is embedded, flows on based on this physical body. And so this gives rise to the idea, the notion that this is all, we are one person, the same person, continuing from birth to death. Now what takes place when death occurs is that this physical body loses its vitality. That is, the life force of this body can no longer continue. It can no longer support the body. And so this body can no longer serve as a basis or support for the flow or continuum of consciousness. But within that stream of consciousness, there is still craving and ignorance. And so when the body falls away, that craving, the craving for the experience through eye, ear, nose, tongue, body and mind, that craving is still intact. And so when the body falls away, the craving can no longer cling to that same body, but it has to go on seeking another physical support, that is, another physical body. And so the craving will drive the stream of consciousness to another physical organism, one which is karmically connected to that stream of consciousness. And when that stream of consciousness finds a physical organism that has just come into existence, that stream of consciousness will connect to that physical organism, that newly fertilized ovum, and that marks the moment of conception. And the moment of conception is the moment of rebirth. And once the stream of consciousness connects to that fertilized egg, then all the five aggregates come into existence together. The fertilized egg, that is the form aggregate, bodily form. The stream of consciousness that connects provides the consciousness aggregate. And with that consciousness there comes feeling, perception, and volitional formations. And so they all arise together at the same moment. There's a debate within the early Buddha schools. Does rebirth or reconception, does it take place immediately after death? Or is there some interval of time between death and the moment of reconception? It's not 100% clear from the suttas themselves, but actually I think from the suttas there's some hints and evidence that there is some time difference between the moment of death and the moment of conception. And within that period, this is what I would speculate, that the stream of consciousness is based then upon a very subtle body moving about seeking a physical organism, a being that will be karmically connected to itself, that will provide the right karma conditions for it to come into existence. And it might be a matter of days, it might be a matter of months, might be a matter of years, until a being with the right situation, the right circumstances, the right parents, all of these things have to come together. But once all of the right factors are present, then the stream of consciousness will connect, and that brings reconception. That brings conception, and conception means rebirth. And what is it that drives that stream of consciousness on from death to new birth? That is craving. And so craving then becomes the cause of dukkha, not in the psychological sense that it causes pain, grief, and misery, but in the sense that it is craving that brings the stream of, that drives the stream of consciousness from one life to the next. And we see this in the wording of the statement, what is the origin of suffering? Okay, it is craving which brings renewal of being. And here the Pali word is quite significant. The Pali word that's translated brings renewal of being is ponobhavika. And ponobhavika is based on the word punabhava. And the word punabhava means again becoming or renewed existence. And punabhava is, in a sense, a synonym for the samsaric process. It describes the process of going through birth or existence again and again. And so when craving is called ponobhavika, it means that craving is what leads on to this repetition of existence, this repeated turning of the wheel from birth through old age, through sickness, through death. And then craving is accompanied by delight and lust. These actually are, I consider them to be two aspects of craving. Taking delight means clinging to things with enjoyment. When the desire is fulfilled and one clings to things and enjoys them. And then lust or raga means desiring what one does not have. And then the other phrase, delights in this and that, tatra tatrabi nandini. I think it's better translated, seeking delight here and there. That indicates how craving is continually looking for pleasure, looking for delight in one object after another object after another object. And then it goes on seeking delight in one state of existence after another state of existence after another state. Okay, this formula mentions three types of craving, and these become standard terms and explanations of the Second Noble Truth. Craving for sense pleasures, craving for existence, and craving for non-being or non-existence. Okay, the meaning of craving for sense pleasures is pretty straightforward. The meaning craving for existence. Okay, the commentaries explain craving for existence is to be craving connected with an eternalist view. And craving for non-existence to be craving connected with an annihilationist view. That is, craving for existence would be craving connected with the view that I have an eternal self and that there's some maybe eternal reality like an eternal God, and the object is for me with my eternal soul or self to reach that eternal paradise or eternal God, or in the Brahmanic view, to go on with this, to uncover this eternal Atman within myself, to discover the eternal true self, the permanent everlasting self. And then the craving for annihilation is the craving that's connected with a view of annihilation. That is a view that we exist just temporarily, that the mind is completely dependent upon the body, and the person just exists, comes into existence at birth, exists for a limited lifespan, and then with the death of the body, the self is completely destroyed, or the person is completely destroyed and doesn't exist in any form, in any way after death. Okay, that is the commentarial explanation. I'm not sure that I would agree with it completely, because it seems that there can be craving for existence doesn't have to be connected with an eternalist view. But I would say that everybody has craving for existence except those who are fully enlightened. So even those of us who are don't hold to eternalist views, who accept Buddhist views, still we have craving for existence. If somebody locks us into a room and says, we're going to put an end to you now, we want to go on existing, right? We just don't accept it with perfect equanimity. And the craving for annihilation, normally we would think that it would be the kind of craving that would, or the situation where a person feels such misery, such despair, that they commit suicide with the idea that by taking my life, I can eliminate all my problems. But I haven't found any explanation in the suttas that would support that interpretation. In fact, I have to say the suttas don't give very much explanation of the craving for annihilation. But only a few hints would suggest that it is the craving of those thinkers who hold that at death, a person is completely cut off and annihilated and doesn't exist after death. And so they have this craving for the annihilation that follows death. And it would be interesting to see if somebody could work out a fully developed interpretation of the craving for annihilation. But there's not very much explanation in the suttas of what this means. Okay, are there any questions relating to my explanation of the origin of suffering? It has to be questions really just pertaining to the subject.
We have three kinds of defilement. Okay, in the classification of craving, it seems it's only discussed with these two first two levels of defilement, not discussed yet with the defilement of ignorance.
What do you mean by the three levels of defilement?
In Sutta number 2,
yeah,
talks about all the pains.
Yeah.
Okay, and then usually it is pains are classified into three categories.
The three pains, yeah.
Pains, defilement of sensual desire.
Yeah.
Defilement of attention to being,
yeah,
patient,
Yeah.
And defilement of ignorance.
Right.
Okay. And now it seems here the classification of tanha deals with the first two defilements.
The first two asavas. Yeah. Yeah, the first two taints. Yeah, the first two asavas or taints are these two types, the first two types of craving. The craving for sense pleasures and the craving for existence.
Uh-huh. And some explanation about craving for existence is because of the meditation, because of the meditative state, and then people attach to that state.
Oh, they become attached to the jhanas.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's a kind of existence, and people consider it to be eternal.
Yeah, that is a form of craving for existence, becoming attached to the jhanas.
Does here have something to do with this kind of explanation? Meditative experience?
I don't think only that, but we could say that the craving for existence, bhava-tanha, reaches through all of the stages of these meditative experiences in the sphere of samadhi. So those who reach these high levels of samadhi, if they don't have wisdom, then they will cling to these states of samadhi. And by clinging to these states of samadhi, those states of samadhi then become objects of craving. And that will lead them on to states of rebirth that correspond to those states of samadhi.
Yeah, you described craving as a driving force of rebirth or renewal of consciousness. But then in dependent origination, we have volitional formations as a condition for consciousness.
Yeah.
Get a little mixed up how they resolve each other.
Let us say that the craving and volitional formations go together. They're together, but to treat that in detail, we're going to come into the formulations of dependent origination, so let me hold off on that as we go through the sutta, then we'll come to those different relationships in dependent origination.
Yes, Father, you mentioned an eternal view. If you attain nirvana, would not that be eternal?
I think what's meant by eternalist view is an idea of some kind of eternity in time going on forever in the future, whereas nirvana is timeless, not within time. Is there any further questions? Yeah.
Talking about the deep cause of Buddha, he mentioned that the craving being embedded in the stream of consciousness that gives the illusion of being one person. I'd like to understand that.
Did I say craving? I said it's the fact that this consciousness continues based upon the same body gives the delusion of being the same person. But craving is embedded within that stream of consciousness. But it is the fact that consciousness continues based upon the same physical body.
So it's continuity that gives the delusion.
Yeah, exactly. Okay, let me go on now to the third noble truth. This is the cessation of suffering. Okay, what is the cessation of suffering? It is the remainderless fading away and ceasing, the giving up, relinquishing, letting go, and rejecting of that same craving. This is called the cessation of suffering. Okay, so this truth, the third noble truth, you could say is just almost the converse of the second noble truth, or inverts the logic, the logical relationship between the second and the first noble truth. So if it is craving that gives rise to suffering, then by stopping that craving, one stops suffering. And just as I explained that the second noble truth operates at the two levels, psychological level and the level of deep causation, so the third noble truth also operates at these two levels. We have the level of immediate experience, which we can see for ourselves. If you've ever had an intense craving for something, you imagine that some object that you can imagine, whether some object that you imagine will give you the supreme happiness, and you have this extraordinarily strong craving for it, and then you're suffering so much from not getting it, then suddenly somehow something happens and that desire for the object just falls away. And instead of feeling miserable, suddenly you feel, what a relief. I no longer have that craving hanging around my neck. So this is a kind of, in a very worldly way, you could call that a worldly manifestation of Nibbana here and now. Even if you have like an intense craving to go out to a particular restaurant to enjoy some exotic type of food, and you've been hoping to go for the whole week, been dreaming of going out to that restaurant, planning, setting your whole heart and mind on it, imagining the delicious meal you're going to get, then maybe there comes that night, there'll come, or that day there'll come a blizzard and all of the roads are blocked, you can't go driving, and you feel such frustration and misery. But then suddenly the idea just comes to you, I could be content at home just by making a very simple meal, and then the desire for that exotic meal just falls away, and you're just very happy with the simple homemade meal. Okay, that's just at a mundane level a kind of metaphor for the way this falling away of craving can bring a little cessation of suffering here and now. Okay, but when we speak about the cessation of craving, the cessation of the defilements, we speak in, based on the suttas, we speak about three levels, three ways in which, three degrees in which the defilements cease. I've spoken about this previously, I think about a year ago. Okay, these are four ways, or actually three ways, the three levels at which the defilement ceases, at which craving ceases. What's called tadanga nirodha, this means, you could call it, cessation in a particular respect, cessation through factor substitution. Okay, this means that one develops a particular antidote to a certain defilement, and by developing that antidote, one is able to temporarily eliminate the defilement. So, for example, for sensual craving, one develops the meditation on the unattractive nature of the body. Meditation on the body is made up of different organs, tissues, fluids, and so on. And then that helps to reduce the sensual lust, sensual craving. For anger, ill will, one develops the meditation on loving kindness that helps to eliminate or remove anger and ill will. Okay, the second kind of cessation, this is called vikambana nirodha. This is cessation through suppression. And this means the attainment of the meditative absorptions. So by developing samadhi meditation, one is able to overcome the five hindrances and all the other defilements in their active forms, and one could enter into a very deep state of peace, quiet, bliss, and one-pointed absorption of the mind. And in that state of meditative absorption, there's no trace of the defilements at all. And so it seems that the defilements are gone, but they're not really eliminated, but they're just brought to a state of temporary cessation. But that peace of samadhi can carry over into one's everyday life, and so the defilements never become active. So somebody who masters samadhi can think that they are perfectly liberated. But the defilements are just in a state of quiescence. Okay, the third kind of cessation is called samuccheda nirodha. This is cessation through eradication, through cutting off. This is the cessation that's achieved by developing wisdom. And when one develops wisdom to the level of the penetrative wisdom, then one can cut off the defilements completely so that they will never arise again. Okay, so the aim of Buddha's practice is to reach this samuccheda nirodha, to cut off these defilements completely so that they can never arise again. But now, the possibility of cutting off the defilements completely depends upon a state, a reality which is completely free from defilements, which is ever-existing, that is called achanta nirodha. That is the ultimate cessation of the defilements. That is a reality, a state, which is the ultimate cutting off or cessation of all defilements. That is Nibbana. And so it is the reality of Nibbana which makes possible the cutting off of all defilements. And when all defilements are cut off completely, then one realizes the state of Nibbana. And so the third noble truth, the cessation of suffering, is actually the, at one level we could say it is the third type of cessation, the cutting off of all defilements completely so that they can never arise again. But in another sense, it is the ultimate cessation, the fourth kind of cessation here. It is that state which is achieved by cutting off all defilements. That state that is realized by cutting off all defilements, the complete cessation of suffering. And then the fourth noble truth is the way leading to the cessation of suffering. This is the Noble Eightfold Path of right view, right intention, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right concentration, right mindfulness, right effort, right mindfulness, right concentration. Okay, so it is this practice of the Noble Eightfold Path that brings the cessation, that enables one to cut off the defilements completely, and that brings the realization of the cessation of suffering. And so in paragraph 19, Venerable Sariputta repeats the same statement that we have come across in paragraph 12, but now it's stated by way of understanding the Four Noble Truths. Okay, now I'll ask again whether there's any questions relating to the third, fourth Noble Truths.
I'm not sure I understand the difference between the three and four. Is one of them the actual removal and the other one the state that you're in after you remove them, or am I just not understanding?
That's correct, except that number four is not only a state that one is in after the removal, but Nibbana is considered as something which is pre-existing. It is something that always exists, since Nibbana is unconditioned. It doesn't come into existence. To use an analogy, like Nibbana is the city and the path is like the road leading to the city. The road doesn't bring the city into existence, but the road leads to the city, and by taking the road, one comes to the city. And it is the existence of Nibbana which makes possible the eradication of the defilements. Since when one develops wisdom, it is when wisdom realizes the third noble truth, when it sees the truth of Nibbana, that the defilements are actually cut off.
Is this the Samuchaya Naroda, is that referring to the three noble persons accepting Arahant?
The Samuchaya Naroda, this is what is accomplished by all four of the realizations. The realizations that bring each of the four stages. So the first realization, which brings the stage of stream entry, cuts off certain defilements, the realization that brings the stage of once returner cuts off certain defilements, the realization that brings the stage of non-returner cuts off certain defilements, then the realization that brings the stage of arahant cuts off the remaining defilements.
So is a way to understand the distinction between 3 and 4, path and fruit?
No, fruit is something else. Requires a rather technical discussion that I don't want to get into. But four is not the fruit of the path. Sometimes the commentators introduce a fifth Nirodha in between 3 and 4 as fruition. I don't want to mention that because it depends upon a rather technical distinction. The fourth is beyond fruition. Any questions? Further questions? Tom?
It goes back to the second level of food. But, you said that the craving migrates into a new life that's karmically connected. What would be like a karmically connected? What would be like an example of something that's karmically connected? Like how is a fetus
going to
be karmically connected to the person that just died?
Of course, the fetus itself can't be karmically connected because the fetus didn't really exist before. But it would be the situation in which the fetus or the being just coming in is existing. To give an example, let us say the being who's passing away had strong karmic connection from an earlier life with certain people who have now become married and are existing as a couple. And so there are certain like karmic relationships to be worked out. Yeah, so to be worked out. So now the being who's passing away has to work out these karmic relationships. And so that is what is drawing him to this particular couple. But it might be the case that time that the being passes away, that, say, the couple, either they're not having sexual relations or the woman is not fertile yet. The woman, her time has not come. And so the conception is not able to take place. Or the rebirth is not able to take place. That is why I think that there would have to be some time interval. But when the sexual relations take place and the woman is fertile, then that is the moment when that consciousness will link up. Okay, it might be, I think, always there will be some personal relationship between the being and the people who will be the parents, but there will also be other factors. It might be that this being is to be reborn under certain economic conditions. Maybe it will be conditions of poverty or conditions of wealth or certain educational advantages. Maybe the parents are in the academic world, and so that will enable that being to get some educational advantages.
If a person who's reached the body dies, does that consciousness still exist, or does it exist anymore?
Then the consciousness doesn't exist as consciousness anymore. That doesn't go on existing as a stream of consciousness. Any further questions? Okay, then we will stop for the evening and then continue. Next week we begin on the sequence of dependent origination.